And it is Election Day 2006, the day that the voters speak. At stake, control of the Senate and the House, with the possibility that Democrats will oust Republicans from both chambers. Democrats need to hold on to two of their seats and take six seats from the Republicans to win the Senate. Republicans need to hold on 15 of their chairs in the House to keep control of that chamber. There are also 36 gubernatorial races up for grabs and over 200 ballot questions. And then there are the machines. About a third of voters are using new electronic voting equipment for the first time. A record number of poll watchers from both parties, as well as independent observers, are monitoring polling stations across the country. There have been early glitches reported in Ohio and Indiana. We'll have more on that. But first, we want to turn to Missouri, scene of one of the tightest Senate races in the country. Incumbent Republican Senator Jim Talent and the Democratic challenger, State Auditor Claire McCaskill, are in a dead heat in the polls. That race and a divisive stem cell ballot initiative are expected to bring in the voters an estimated 70% of the electorate in some areas. And add to that some recent changes in voting procedures, and you've got a recipe for an interesting day. We turn to Joe Manis, political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's been at the polls and joins us from St. Louis. Joe, give us a sense of what's going on. Is the turnout as high as expected?
Well, at least in the St. Louis metro area, it is. And it's creating that, plus the fact that we are using these new voting systems. It's a combination of optical scan and touchscreen in most of the counties surrounding the city of St. Louis.
Well, in fact, we heard that Senator Jim Talent had to wait an hour at the polls this morning, his challenger about a half that time, and it took one voter 20 minutes just to vote.
Yes. In all of this is occurring in St. Louis County, which is the largest voting block in the state, and that's all the suburbs that surround the city of St. Louis. The city of St. Louis is not part of the county. The county is like a large donut that surrounds the city. The county just went to these new systems in our August primary, and there were some problems then, although a recount later showed that everything was fairly accurate, but there was just a lot of problems on Election Day. There had been predictions and concern that this would happen again, because the county not only is the largest jurisdiction, it's also the largest swing jurisdiction.
How would you characterize it there today?
Well, it's been a zoo so far this morning, and I'm not knocking anybody, but it's just been very chaotic. I've been getting phone calls since 8 a.m. Our newspaper had special email set up for people to report problems, and that's been packed all day. We've got reporters on the streets that are checking into some of this stuff. I've been on the phone with various election officials, so have some other people. There is just a lot of confusion out there among some election workers. Part of it because until about 6 weeks ago, they thought that we were going to have a law that required people to show photo ID at the polls.
Right, we understand.
To show ID, but not photo ID.
Right,
we
understand.
The Supreme Court knocked that out 6 weeks ago, but you still have some election judges who are demanding that, even though that's not the law, and so then you have lawyers on site, and it clogs things.
We understand that the state Supreme Court did rule last month that the photo ID requirement was struck down, but even the Secretary of State today was asked to present a photo ID three times when she went to cast her absentee ballot this week. Joe Manis, a political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, you've got your hands full there. Thanks for touching in with us.
Thank you.
Well, we turn out of New Jersey, where Republican Senate candidate Thomas Kane is facing incumbent Democrat Robert Menendez in one of the nation's most closely watched races. Cynthia Burton has been following this one for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Cynthia, I know you voted early this morning in Haddonfield, New Jersey, just outside of Philadelphia. How's the turnout?
Well, the turnout's very light, even in the urban areas where the Democrats were hoping that it would be heavy. That could change, though. A U.S. Senate race, as interesting as it is to you and me, is not quite as interesting to the local party machines.
Well, and we understand that in some of the cases, they've been trying to keep voters away, to keep independents away from the polls.
Well, yes, and that's very subtle. Both campaigns have been extraordinarily negative, even by New Jersey standards, and it's a real blood feud in New Jersey, pretty much every statewide race. The point of such dark advertising is to keep swing voters, independent voters, away. While most of those people vote Democratic, They're not deeply affiliated with a party, and they compose the bulk. There's 4.8 million people registered to vote. 2 million of those are what we call unaffiliated.
All right. Well, this is the first time all 21 New Jersey counties are using touchscreen machines. We understand recently a Princeton researcher told a state judge that he thinks he can break into these machines in less than 10 minutes and manipulate the voting mechanism. So given that, have there been any problems?
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Not yet.
And any other problems that you're seeing at the polls in light of what we're hearing down in Missouri with, ballots and scanning and all the problems that are surfacing there?
Well, so far things are going fairly routinely. You hear a report of a machine not working in a liberal suburb of Newark, but not a whole lot beyond that.
Cynthia Burton, covering the U.S. Senate race in New Jersey for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Cynthia, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, aside from voters, tens of thousands of volunteers are out at polling places around the country today making sure there aren't election problems. One group known as Video the Vote has about 1,000 volunteers filming balloting across the country. Melissa Giroux is voting rights activist, and she's with the group. She and other volunteers are monitoring the balloting from her home in Columbus, Ohio. Melissa, what have you been hearing from the polling places so far?
Ooh, there are a lot of problems, especially in Ohio. The highest, we at Video the Vote are working with our partners at Election Protection, and so people call in incidents to the 866-R-VOTE line, and the highest number of incidents has been coming in from Ohio.
What kinds of things are people calling about?
Broken machines, provisional ballots being used when perhaps they shouldn't be used. ID problems, poll workers not knowing the rules. We're getting all sorts of reports.
Well, we understand, for instance, in Ohio, it's the first time they're going to be using voter identification requirements, and different counties implement the ID rules differently. Some interpret current utility bill as being 30 days old, some 120 days old. So these might be some of the questions that come up. And it sounds as if you're saying that there are, volunteers at the polls who may not be aware of some of the different rules.
That's exactly right. The rules are so different county to county that it can be confusing if you move or simply because they change at the last minute. A lot of times in the weeks before the election, there are a lot of changes, maybe especially in Ohio these days, in the election laws. But, Robin, another thing, a thing that's happening that's very exciting with Video the Vote is we're getting, because we have teams of volunteers who responded. I think we got so many volunteers, 1,000 in very little time, to go out and videotape, document at the polls, because there's a real concern that there's something wrong with the system.
Well, and what are you doing with these videos once you get them?
We're uploading them to the Internet and to YouTube so that everyone can see them the same day as the election. We're really trying to make this the most documented election ever and trying to change the way it's reported so that it's not about the horse race, but really about what's happening, the nitty-gritty at the polls.
Well, a lot of your partners in Video the Vote, including Common Cause, People for the American Way, Rock the Vote, are seen as somewhat left-leaning. And I'm just wondering, I know you've tried to train these videographers, and you hope to be nonpartisan, but given that so many of the partners are left-leaning, there may be concerns that they're only going to focus their lens on problems they want to see. Republicans, for instance, are very concerned that people might come to the polls with false IDs. So, for instance, if an illegal immigrant is caught with false IDs, is this something that you're asking your videographers to take pictures of?
We want it all, Robin. I mean, we even want the happy stories, and we'd be happiest if there were no incidents to report or to document and all our volunteers were bored for the day.
Melissa Giroux, she's with the group Video the Vote. Thousands of volunteers out hoping to videotape people who've had problems at the polls. Melissa, thanks very much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, let's round it out with Doug Chapin, director of the nonpartisan group ElectionLine.org, his group keeping an eye on potential problems at the polls as well through news sites and through its network of bloggers. Doug, we just heard not that many problems in New Jersey, but in Missouri, it's a zoo, we're told. And we're hearing about problems in Indiana. Now, Indiana was going to be a bellwether state for observers. Polls were supposed to close at 6 p.m. There were some tight races there, and it was thought, you know, maybe if so as goes Indiana, maybe the country. But now there's been a change. What's happened?
Well, we've seen problems in a couple of counties, Robin, with voting technology. Delaware County and, to a lesser extent, Marion County, which houses Indianapolis, had trouble getting their machines started this morning. In fact, Delaware County claims that because of problems with the programming of their machines by their vendor, Microvote, that they couldn't start any of their machines. The result is that they're going to be delaying closing the polls. We don't yet know how long, but it will almost certainly be past the 6 o'clock hour, which is when they would close. Same thing in Marion County, although there the local clerk is blaming it more on poll workers either not showing or not knowing how to power up those machines first thing.
We've been hearing that the poll closings in at least some counties in Indiana might be 8:45. And we've been scanning the wires and local and television and newspaper sites. In the Pittsburgh area, the Associated Press is reporting voting machine problems at 13 polling stations in Allegheny County. Some cases, voters are being given paper ballots. In Maryland, reports that a few locations are handing out provisional ballots because the new electronic voting machines aren't working properly. When there are problems with these new machines, what are election workers supposed to do?
Well, it depends on state law. In many places, they're supposed to have some sort of a backup ballot if the voter needs or wants an emergency ballot. Some state laws provide for that. Others, they're just required to troubleshoot the machine and make it work. The problem is that is a fairly complex task, which many poll workers simply haven't been trained to follow through on.
Yeah. What else are you seeing from your vantage point?
Oh, we're seeing lots of the things that you're reporting. The machine problems, the questions about ID. I think Melissa's observation about poll workers being confused about ID laws is the sort of thing that we may see in other states around the country. It's not surprising what we've seen so far. I mean, every problem is one problem too many. I think it's heartening, at least at this point, that nothing is along the line of a major meltdown. But you know, the day is still young.
I was just going to say. It's quite early yet. Doug Chapin, director of the nonpartisan group ElectionLine.org. Just to the ID question, all of these questions beg one that, in fact, we're going to hear Europeans are asking, why isn't it the same across the country? You know, why is it different from county to county, state to state? Is there a sense that as these elections continue to have these problems, there might be some kind of a national voting system?
There could be. The thing that people frequently don't appreciate is how strongly rooted in states and localities the American electoral process is. There is no American election system. They really are as a hodgepodge of state and local systems. In fact, on most ballots, it's really more important where you're from than anything else. And that local control is something that's been fairly hard to shake. Now, if there's partisan control in Congress and if there's continued focus on these problems, wouldn't be surprised to see a movement to have a more national approach. Not sure or how successful that'll be given how strongly rooted elections are at the local level.
Doug Chapin, again, director of the nonpartisan group ElectionLine.org. We're going to check in with you tomorrow to see how things actually wound up. Doug, thank you.
My pleasure.
And as we said, we'll get the view from abroad. And why are researchers at major networks locked in a vault today? All coming up here and now. Now, the Guardian newspaper calls it the Day of Reckoning. The Spanish daily ABC notes Bush faces his final electoral tests. And Agence France-Presse states Iraq on the ballot as America votes. This midterm election is being closely watched from abroad. And for more on the coverage overseas, we're joined by Chris Lockwood, the U.S. editor for The Economist magazine in London. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
And it's interesting to us here in the U.S., the election of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua has been on the front page. Is the U.S. midterm election on the front pages there in Europe?
I'm sorry to say it isn't yet, but it will be tomorrow. I'm sure it will be all over the front pages tomorrow. What we've seen today is great big inside page spreads on the possible electoral outcomes.
And what are, you know, how closely are people reading that and watching it?
I'd say they're pretty interested. You know, every day everyone's asking me what's going to happen. Problem is I don't know, but they are very curious.
Yeah, in reading through some comments on The Guardian's website, we noted there seemed to be a lot of questions about the American system. You know, for instance, one reader asked, why don't the Americans elect a leader to the Democratic Party so that there would be an opposition leader? Can you explain, you know, what some of that curiosity is?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference really between the American system and most European systems is there is no very obvious leader of the opposition at any given time. Here in Britain, you know, we clearly have a leader of the opposition. It's more or less true in other countries too. But in America, it's very hard to say who leads the Democrats at the moment. Nancy Pelosi is one possibility. She's the speaker in waiting, but she's certainly not a presidential candidate in 2008. And if the Senate were to fall to the Democrats, she wouldn't even be the senior person in Congress. So it's an odd thing, and people don't really get their heads around it well in Europe.
Right, but they're trying. And what are some of the other ways that these elections, you know, people in Europe feel might affect them? What are some of the things they're thinking might be important to them?
I think the main thing is the war in Iraq. They passionately oppose, for the most part, Europeans, the war in Iraq and the way it's been handled by the administration. I think they are hoping that there will be a blow landed against the administration in these elections so that those policies will be changed a little bit.
So they do feel the policies would change because of midterm congressional elections? You know, this is not changing the White House.
Right. I mean, this is what they hope. I don't think it's fully understood quite how little the impact of a Democratic victory in Congress would actually be on the conduct of foreign policy. You know, you and I may know very well that foreign policy is reserved to the presidency in the American system, but there's still some influence that Congress will have. It can hold hearings, it can debate the conduct of the way the war's been handled, and it's possible that out of that some changes may be not forced, but at least influenced. I suppose that's what people are hoping.
The U.S. has sent observers, most famously former President Jimmy Carter, to other countries to make sure that the things go well. What do Europeans think about, you know, how the system works in the U.S.?
There are some concerns. We saw what happened in Florida in 2000. We saw allegations in Ohio in 2004. And we know that America uses a variety of methods to count the vote, to record the vote and to count it, electronic, electromechanical, mechanical, and that some of them aren't well understood and don't always work well. So there are concerns, and one particular concern this time around is that if, as many people say, the Senate vote or the House vote is a very close vote, there may be a small number of seats in which there are very potent legal challenges, which may even make it impossible to say who's won one of the houses straight away.
Are the voting systems uniform across, let's say, Britain or France? Is there the same? Does everybody who goes to vote do it in the same way?
As far as I know, pretty much every country in Europe has the system determined at a national level. Yes, they're not all the same, the systems, but within each country, it would be the same, yes.
Chris Lockwood, U.S. editor for The Economist in London, giving us a view from abroad of today's elections. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we want to take a minute now to address one of your concerns this election season, how to pronounce the Show Me State. Alex Thornton of Charlotte, North Carolina writes, is it me or are more people suddenly saying Missouri instead of Missouri? I'd always thought this was a Yosemite Sam-like parody, but if there's a new intellectual bandwagon, I need to get on it soon, so please clear this up. Well, Julie Patrick, who works at NPR affiliate WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, was even more concerned after I said Missouri. So we called her up to ask why.
I don't think that it's appropriate to pick up local idioms when you're broadcasting to the nation at large.
Well, you're not even sure it's a local idiom because you grew up in Kansas City?
I grew up in Kansas City. I was born and raised in Kansas City. I never heard anyone say Missouri until about 10 years ago.
Huh, really? What do I know? I'm up here in Boston, born in New York. So I decided to call my former future mother-in-law, Lois Matheny of Lee Summit, Missouri. My memory is she always said Missouri.
Hello.
Lois, how do you pronounce the state you live in?
Missouri.
Ah!
I am originally from Wisconsin, and that's why I say Missouri, but everybody in Missouri says Missouri.
Okay, we'll go to a native son, Lois's son, born and raised in Missouri, or is it Ra?
Hello?
Pat Matheny?
Yes.
How do you pronounce the state you grew up in?
I'm sorry? How do you pronounce the state you grew up in?
Missouri.
I know you do.
Hey! Wow, I thought, what is this? Like some kind of like test?
You say Missouri, right?
I say Missouri.
How do you say roof?
Roof.
There you go. So am I correct in reporting on Missouri to say Missouri?
Well, here's the official deal. If you're from the western side of Missouri, south of Kansas City, you would probably say Missouri. Mm-hmm. If you're from Kansas City, certainly St. Louis or maybe Columbia, you would probably say Missouri. And if you were in the northern part of Missouri, you would definitely say Missouri.
There. I hope that clears things up. I guess the moral is, when in parts of Missouri, do as the Missourians do. Oh, no. Is it Missourians? Missourians? Missourites? Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes
now. By now, polling experts from the major television networks have entered the quarantine room, where they'll be holed up for the next 5 hours crunching the numbers from exit polls. That is the information gleaned from voters this morning. No cell phones are allowed, no Blackberries, and proctors will monitor the door in an attempt to prevent the past problem of projections getting out before the polls close. What are the chances that will work? Joining us on the line first from Washington, Wall Street Journal reporter Amy Schatz. And Amy, are people taking bets on whether or not this will work?
Well, it'll definitely work for some amount of time. But once the doors open at 5 o'clock and the data starts to flow, it's not going to take very long for this information to get out onto the Internet. Basically, the way this works is that you have representatives of the networks. Basically, they're polling directors, they're top political types, who are going to go into this room. There's actually two rooms. There's going to be one in New York where all the networks will be, and there's a different room in Washington where Associated Press will be. It's going to be akin to sort of taking the SAT. You won't be able to leave. They take all of your cell phones and your toys away. They do let you go to the bathroom, but it's a very controlled environment. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that they really want to give these guys a chance to look at the data as it's coming in. These polling data, basically polling data comes in waves. And the folks in this room are going to be deciding, while they're in this room, what are some of the stories tonight that the networks are going to be telling you about? What sort of trends are they going to be seeing? Who voted? What were the major issues on their minds? All of that information they're finding out today as they're sort of combing through this data.
And they're promising, the television networks have promised, not to run the information until all the polls close. But we understand that the anchors, for instance, are on the honor system. They will know some of this information and they'll be on the air. Is there a concern that they might, through some sort of inflection, give away some of the information?
Networks in the past have been very good about not talking about this stuff on the air because, ultimately, it's a poll. It's not necessarily data that could be true. I mean, it's supposed to give you a snapshot of what people were thinking about when they went today, but they're not the actual numbers.
Well, one of the concerns and one of the reasons for the lockdown, we understand, is not so much that the information gets out within the news organizations, but it goes from there to bloggers.
It's going to go out to bloggers very quickly. One of the things that happens here is that at 5 o'clock, a computer system that has been set up by the National Election Pool, which is sort of like this consortium that all of the news organizations came into, they're going to, at 5 o'clock, that data is released, and it goes to all the newsrooms immediately. So it's not like the guys in this room are going to be physically taking the poll data back to their newsrooms. The folks in the newsrooms will already have it, and that means that anybody in that newsroom who can actually access it will be sending it out to their friends. I mean, they're not supposed to, but they're reporters, and reporters can do things like that.
Amy Schatz, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Amy, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, we turn now to Mark Jerkowitz, longtime media watcher, who's now associate director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism in Washington, D.C. And Mark, tell us a little bit about the history behind this concern, why we're locking people in a steel-plated room today. Tell us about some of the past elections where exit polling has been a problem.
Well, I just think it's that the public sort of relishes the idea of all these journalists being locked up and having their toys taken away. You know, for a long time, really, exit polls were, it's almost an article of faith that exit polls were somehow flawless. You know, there was a sense that, you know, yes, people might lie to pollsters or be evasive to pollsters before they actually voted, but that once they came out of the voting booth, they would actually tell the truth. So there's this whole mystique of infallibility about exit polls that have been destroyed fundamentally in the last three election cycles. And you don't have to have that long a memory to remember what happened on election night 2000, particularly when it came to Florida, where the presidency went to Al Gore, then it went back to undecided, then it went to George Bush, then it went back to undecided. It was a huge embarrassment for the networks. In the 2002 off-year election, there was a glitch with the exit poll data and the computers, and a lot of the material wasn't able to be used on air by the anchors. In 2004, in the immortal words of, I think, one of the bloggers, it wasn't me, John Kerry was president for about 7 hours, from about 2 p.m. till 9 p.m., when the exit polls had escaped early in the day, showing him ahead of George Bush, and everybody, every political insider, every journalist in the country thought John Kerry was going to be the president of the United States. Again, that material turned out to be incorrect. So there's a real fear now, I think. You know, A, there's some fear on the part of the consortium that, hey, we pay for this. We put this together. We don't feel like having it doled out for free on the Internet. But the real issue is we have now seen where these, you know, faulty numbers, early numbers, numbers that are relatively meaningless, have really kind of bollocked the political process on Election Day, have embarrassed the networks at night. So there's a real sense of tamping down on these early leaks because, frankly, the information can be questionable.
Well, and there's always been concern that if it's announced on the East Coast, people on the West Coast are still voting. But today's New York Times reports that some of these networks are linking websites to bloggers who may be posting these exit polls because they're not, you know, they don't feel the same allegiance to some of the pledges that the networks have made. In which case, some of the networks have said, well, if it shows up on a blog, we'll report on it because then it's news.
Yeah, I mean, I frankly think that seems a little intellectually inconsistent to me. First of all, I think there will be a little tighter control this year. At a minimum, we may not get get the exit polls leaked till at least after 5 p.m. as opposed to mid-afternoon when it used to happen. So I think that's a break. There are a number of bloggers, a number of people online that we talked to, frankly, at the project who said they're not going to do what they've done in the past, which is to leak these exit polls. So we may have less leaking. But the bottom line is, if you're part of the consortium or if you've made this agreement not to leak this data and, frankly, not to predict winners in races before the polls close, to then say, well, we will have to if we're linking to somebody who actually has reporting it rather than you know, pretending it doesn't exist, that's to me, that's very intellectually inconsistent and certainly not in keeping with the spirit of this whole consortium and this attempt to really tamp down on these leaks.
Well, by the way, ABC says they will remove links to blogs that don't meet the requirements of their network. And ABC is also using college students to send in reports from college campuses. They're going to be linked up to cell phones and such. What do you make of that? I mean, is that useful, gimmickry? What is that?
Well, it's a combination of both, frankly. I mean, you know, caveat emptor on this kind of information. These people are not sort of trained journalists. But on the other hand, the more information and the more anecdotal stuff that comes in, the better we are. There are a lot of reporting on Election Day on various blogs, and there was in the last election cycle, from people who went to their polling booths and came back and said, you know, it was more crowded than I expected, or this happened or that happened. I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of sort of first-person citizen reporting recorded on blogs on Election Day today, and I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think it'll actually give us some insight into what's going to happen later in the day.
Well, some people might say, you know, the college students may not be trained, but neither are some of the exit poll volunteers.
Well, that's a very good point. You know, there was a postmortem for what happened in 2004, and while they didn't single this out per se, there was a sense that some of the exit poll canvassers who interviewed people after they voted were not properly trained, were a little too young, and so that was an issue. They claim this year, the National Exit Poll, they claim that they've worked out those kinks, that there is better training, and that they won't have some of the data and methodological errors they've had in the past. This year, if they actually keep the embargo, we may not know.
Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism in Washington, D.C. Mark, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
And still to come, The New Yorker's Roz Chast, professional cartoonist, professional phobic. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, millions of Americans will cast votes today, and many of them are immigrants who enter the voting booth with more than a passing glance to their past.
My name is Lucy Smith. I am 73 years old, and I grew up in Poland, and I am American citizen now. I was 18 and I voted because I was proud of the fact that I could. There was vote for one and only candidate for president. It was not decision, of course, but the fact that I was allowed to participate in that circus was something important for my ego.
My name is David. I'm from Togo, and I've been living in St. Paul, Minnesota for the last 5 years. Togo has been under, you know, a military dictatorship from 1967. I can say up until now, because you still have the son of the former dictator that's running the country now. Every time that there were elections where the opposition participated, every single time they won the elections, but the power which is in control of making public the result never did actually publish the truth.
In 1968, I was married to an American, and we lived in Europe for 8 years and then decided to come here. The idea that people have of United States, that they come here for getting freedom, it means that everyone that lives in that system is told you have rights. In practice, doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
There are freedoms that are available here that are weren't in where I come from. The first one I can think of is freedom of expression. You know, you can speak your mind. You can write almost anything you want. And no fearing to be arrested, jailed, or killed. But the only difference that I would say from the perception that I had and from the reality actually is that not many people are taking advantage of this freedom. Not many people are exercising these freedoms.
They take it for granted because they did not see anything else. And maybe they were not taught enough the history of how difficult it was, how many people lost their lives and freedoms, and how much they sacrificed for the right to vote.
In Togo, they just needed freedom. And, you know, they want to speak their mind, they want to wanted to make things better, they want a better life. I mean, if you only knew how it's like to live under a dictatorship, I think you would understand.
David Takasi from Togo and Lucy Smith, who grew up in communist Poland, their stories were produced by Sandin Totten for Minnesota Public Radio's In the Loop. We now have another quick check on the poll monitoring today in light of new machines and new voter ID laws. The citizens watchdog group Common Cause says its national voter hotline is ringing off the hook. Voters across the country phoning the group's national hotline to get information and report problems. Pennsylvania voters have made the most calls, followed by voters from California, New York, and Ohio. Arizona voters are also calling in with questions about the new voter ID law there. Stay with us. We'll keep tabs on it all. Much more ahead here and now. now. And now a break from politics for a look at the things that are really important, such as what would Rosemary's Baby look like at 27? Or instead of Mars and Venus, what if men were from Belgium and women were from New Brunswick? Just some of the musings of Roz Chast. For over 25 years, Roz Chast's squiggly, some have said crumbly cartoons have appeared on the pages of The New Yorker, Red Book, and Scientific American magazines, chronicling her daily anxieties and, oh, let's face it, their hours too. Who hasn't had a 3 p.m. of the soul, sitting on the love seat trying to decide whether to defrost the lamb chops or vacuum the hall rug? Or Tuesday night fever, sewing, washing the windows, catching up on a novel? Over 500 of Roz Chast's cartoons have now been collected in a new coffee table book called Theories of Everything, Selected, Collected, Health-Inspected Cartoons by Roz Chast, 1978 to 2006. And you can see some of them, by the way, on our website, here-now.org, as we welcome Roz Chast from Yale University. Welcome, Roz.
Thank you for having me.
What a fun, big, very big book. This is, and the New York Times says, it charts an appealingly perverse course from urban befuddlement to suburban bewilderment.
That about describes it, yeah. It's my own personal trajectory.
Can you explain the befuddlement and the bewilderment? I mean, how would you characterize it?
I think it's sort of waking up every day, wondering a little bit why you're here, and then you don't have any time to really figure that one out. So then you have to get onto your next thing, worry, crisis, whatever, and then finally you get to go back to sleep at the end of the day.
Oh, that's a lovely approach to life. We're thinking about things like, oh, perhaps what was Jacques Cousteau like as a kid? I've got the book open to, this one is entitled The Young Jacques Cousteau at the Beach with His Mother, and you see a mom on a chaise lounge, and there's a little boy holding up like a fish skeleton saying, regarde.
Bunches of seaweed.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. You know, I do get asked sometimes, you know, where do you get your ideas? Where do you get, where did the ideas come from? I don't know.
Well, it seems as if sometimes in a very, you know, obvious way, like an idea, deeper into the idea, deeper into the idea. I'm looking, for instance, at topic processor.
Uh-huh.
And the first square says, discuss, and underneath there's a guy with a thought balloon over his head says, hey, does anyone remember last summer? Then the next block, rehash. A woman says, last summer was fun. Hmm? The next one, puree. And a guy says, quite a summer, am I right? And finally we land on liquefy. That was some summer. Is that part of the process, sort of taking something and where can I go with this?
I think a friend of mine was saying that most cartoonists are a little bit outsiders. We like to eavesdrop and listen to people. And sometimes, you know, in this particular cartoon, I'm sure it was just like hearing something rehashed so many times and saying the same thing in so many ways. And eventually it does sort of get down to liquefy.
There's nothing left. But you're also an insider in a very particular arena, and that's the home. I mean, it seemed like a lot of the cartoons are from Roz, the mom, the homemaker, as frightened at times of the home as any place.
Yes. Well, my mother used to talk about objects having a life of their own, and she used a phrase, the conspiracy of the inanimate. I don't think she made it up, but it was certainly something I grew up with and totally understand.
I met on display at the Children's House of Horrors. It goes to this point. You see in one drawing, the Hall of Snowsuits. The next, the plate where all the different foods are touching one another. And then the gallery of inexplicable fears, and there's a hairdryer, a fan, a kite. Is this right from your own? I mean, anyone who's tried to put a snowsuit on a three-year-old.
It's a very, very bad thing. And I have two older kids now, but when they were little, getting them into the snowsuit was really, really bad. But I have lots of memories of finally getting them totally bundled up into the snowsuit, into the scarf, into the boots, into the mittens, and they're just totally, you know, packaged up. And then you get out of the house for about 2 minutes, and it's like, then they have to go to the bathroom. Right. And you just want to look at them and go, you're kidding me, you know? Of course, when they're like three, no, they're not kidding you. They're not, you know, just trying to yank your chain. They have to go to the bathroom. It didn't occur to them before you packed them into the snowsuit.
And yet, you know, Family Circus, for instance, might have the cartoon be just that. They bundle up the kid in the snowsuit, and then two frames later, I have to go to the bathroom. You put the snowsuit in the Hall of Scary Snowsuits.
Yeah, Well, that was, you know, there were other things in that cartoon. The food's touching and the fears. And, you know, I was afraid of kites when I was a kid. I have no idea why.
Really?
I think I had this fear that I would be holding onto the kite and it would suddenly go up in the air or something. And, you know, who knows? You know, sometimes like an uncle will say something to you in jest when you're a kid, you know, because they think it's funny. And suddenly, you know, you don't know. When you're a little kid, you might take it for total truth. My mother's older brother used to tell her there was a plug at the bottom of the ocean.
No.
And like some, you know, that plug could just be pulled and the whole ocean would go down the drain. You know, when you're a little kid, you believe anything.
I'm looking at The Adventures of Wimp Mom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This, explain this one.
What I remember, it came from this time I was reading with my son, and he was little and he was kind of cranky. It might have been like right after a nap or right before a nap, who knows. And it was just like one of those things where you say anything. It's like, no, they weren't, you know. Yeah. And I think I said something like, dinosaurs were very, very big. Right. He goes, no, they weren't. And I said, okay, they weren't very big. They were tiny. Dinosaurs were as tiny as peas. And I think at the time it really, you know, then I started laughing, you know.
The Adventures of Wimpy Mom.
Yeah, what a wimpy, wimpy mom.
One last I have to ask you about, because I grew up around your way out on Long Island, and there's one entitled Remains of an Ancient Suburb.
Oh, yeah.
I recognize the artificial fruit from Syosset.
Ah, yes, yes. It's very well known. It's a very valuable relic.
Well, in the introduction, as you said, it's a phone book. It's big. And it says it contains all of your anxieties, fears, superstitions, failures, furies, insecurities, and dark imaginings. Is there one or is there a series that, you know, really speaks to who you are?
They kind of all do. I know that's a kind of wimpy, wimpy answer. But one of my favorites, it's actually kind of a genre cartoon. You know, those cartoons that are like the end of the world guys? Those guys with, like, the long white beard and the kind of tattered robes, and they're holding up signs that the end is near. And one time I was drawing one of these guys, and I really didn't know where I was going with it. I just felt like drawing one of these guys, so I did. And then I gave him a wife, and she's kind of the female equivalent of him, and her sign says, "You wish." I guess I kind of like that one.
Ross Chast, the book is called Theories of Everything, Selected, Collected, Health Inspected Cartoons by Ross Chast, 1978-2006. So 28 years worth of work. As you said, your kids are grown. I'm just, you know, some would say, what's left to mine? I mean, that in that time, perhaps all the anxieties have been gotten out. Are there
I think it gets worse as you get older. Because then you have your own mortality is just that much closer.
Oh, boy. Mortality.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that one. Roz, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
And again, to see the cartoons of Roz Chast we've been talking about, go to our website, here-now.org. And this song, this is Bill Frisell's cartoon. We'll hear more of his eclectic music later this week. And don't forget tomorrow, full coverage of the day after the midterm elections of 2006. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us then, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join